This is the Sklo Library Podcast. Today we are joined by Dr. John Gastel from Penn State University. He's a distinguished professor in communication arts and sciences and political science, and a senior scholar at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy. With Katie Knobloch from Colorado State University, Dr. Gastel has authored a new book, Hope for Democracy: How Citizens Can Bring Reason Back into Politics. Dr. Gastel, thanks for speaking with us today.
It is a pleasure to join you on the pod.
In your book, you and Professor Knobloch write about some exciting things going on in local politics in Oregon that might have major consequences for making our democracy more deliberative. Can you describe what the Citizens Initiative Review in Oregon is, and how does it work?
So in 2009, the state legislature passed into law this unusual process, where Oregon is one of the many states that has ballot measures that appear every couple of years in the case of Oregon, and voters are voting directly on legislation. Well, that 2009 law said, let's try something. Let's take a random sample of the public, just a couple dozen people, give them a week to study one of these ballot measures, and hear from some neutral experts, hear from the advocates and opponents of the ballot measure, and then write a one-page statement that says, here are the key findings, things we feel everyone needs to know in Oregon before they vote, and here's what we found to be the best arguments for and against this measure. That then went into the official voter's guide in Oregon. So Oregon's one of the many states that provides some kind of a printed guide. It looks like a sort of mini phone book sent out to all the registered voters. But this adds something really different, right? It adds the information that your fellow citizens think you need. And they're in a better position to give you that information than an elected or appointed official who may want, you know, part of their job is giving you to wanting to give you good information, but part of their job is being super nonpartisan. And so they tend to produce information that's a little too dry on these issues, whereas the citizens got right to the point, right? And so it went well enough in 2010 that Oregon then in 2011 made it a permanent part of the electoral process. And it's been kind of humming along with little bumps in the road ever since. And now other places are thinking of adopting this because it not only produces good statements, right? Those 24 citizens deliberate really well, but it's also clearly having an impact on the election. It's making voters better informed, and we hope helping them arrive at more reflective judgments when they actually vote.
How are participants selected to serve on the board?
Basically at random. It's a little more complicated than that, and you have to be a registered voter to be in that initial population that is randomly sampled. But it's random. There is a fancy word called stratified random samples. So stratified means it's not truly random. I mean, if it was truly random, we could wind up with 24 people from Portland whose, you know, middle name is Mary. That's random, baby. But no, chance is so lumpy that you need to stratify. You need to say, all right, well, it should be roughly half men and women. It should roughly be these many people from Eastern and Western Oregon and so on. And you don't want to overdo that, but you do come up with that way a broadly representative small group while still being random in principle.
What effect does the CIR have on both the participants and on voters who vote on issues informed by the review board's findings?
Well, the effect on the participants who do it is profound. Prior to studying this, I've been studying this along with Katie Knobloch for the last 10 years. Prior to that, for 10 years, I studied the American jury system, in particular to study the impact of serving on a jury. No one had really looked at what happens to these jurors. Does it change how they think of themselves as citizens? And the bottom line is that for many jurors, especially those who are a little bit politically engaged, that is, they have voted at some time, but they're not regular voters, they get a lot of benefit from serving on a jury, right? It's kind of a civic awakening being in the jury room. It reminds you, democracy is self-government. I am the judge, right? The judge is looking to the 12 of us and saying, not my job. You know, what's the verdict, kids? Okay, that's super empowering, right? Well, in Oregon, you're not deciding someone's fate, right, in the same power as a jury. Instead, you're deciding what information to give voters, but in a way, it's actually more consequential, right? Because if you were to serve on a jury, if you were, say, to, you know, go to the courthouse in Bellefonte, you know, you'd be handling a very serious matter that involves a few people who are in the courtroom. If you're on the Oregon Citizens Initiative Review, you're deciding what goes in the voting guide to every single registered voter. Every person you know in Oregon who's a registered voter is going to hear what you had to say, right? You and your fellow citizen. It's an incredible power. And again, that's why it's encouraging that the effect is not just on those panelists, who many of them are really truly moved by the experience, but the effect is then seen for the larger public. What's a little bit surprising, and credit to, again, to Katie Knobloch for even thinking of this, the larger public is not only becoming more knowledgeable about the issue at hand before they vote, but they're also getting some secondary effects. They're changing a little bit their attitude towards the Oregon government, giving it, frankly, a little bit of credit for having created this thing that helps them be better voters. And they're giving themselves a little credit. If they take the time to read the citizen statement, it tends to make them feel more efficacious, more generally efficacious. That is, I'm a little more confident that I know how to do this democracy thing, but also more specifically efficacious. That is, you know, when I'm filling out my ballot and I get to measure 82, I think I know how to vote on it now. Previously, I might've skipped it, right? And a lot of voters do skip things that are down the ballot. So again, all kinds of effects on both the panelists who are randomly selected and then that wider public who reads their statement.
When I hear people complain about the state of our democracy, one of the major themes that presents itself is the idea that there is no efficacious vector for their input. And this seems to be a bipartisan opinion, maybe the only thing that our society, split by political tribalism, may agree on. It seems like the Citizens Review Board addresses the kind of baked-in homophily that keeps us divided in our daily life. But also, if voters are getting confidence to have a role in the system, it seems like two of the big social dilemmas of our democracy are addressed at this local level.
Well, I'll tell you what, every day is a good day if I hear some string of words that I've never heard before in my life and probably never will again. Baked-in homophily is today's three-word secret code. So thank you for making this an excellent day for the listeners and myself. Tribalism, let's start with that. The people who serve on the Citizens Initiative Review Panel, because they're from the state of Oregon, which is really a purple state in many ways, they're politically pretty diverse. A lot of independents, Republicans, and Democrats. A common refrain from the panelists is, like on the last day, you know, I kind of forgot. When I came here, I was curious who was a Republican, who was a Democrat. And now I'm realizing I kind of forgot. And one of the things that's built into the process of the CIR, as the Citizens Initiative Review is commonly called, my favorite little process feature is this. So you have to write key findings and pro and con arguments, right? The pro and con arguments are being written by subgroups that include people who are for and against the measure. So the pro arguments are being written by some people who are for it and some people who are against it, and they work together really collaboratively. Initially, back when the process started, they would separate the pro and the con sides, but then they would have time for them to critique each other. And the critiques were not, are you kidding? That's a ridiculous argument. The critiques were more along the lines of, oh, you know, actually you talk about enforcement of drug policy, I'm afraid that's going to freak people out, because remember, this is just about medical marijuana. And the other side says, well, that's what we meant with medical marijuana. And the other side says, yeah, but it sounds like you're talking about legalizing cocaine. And they're like, oh, geez, no, I see what you mean. Yes, okay, we'll clarify that, right? So they were helping each other, right? Now they just, you know, why not just start with that, right? Everybody is generating the pro and con arguments. You're asked to imagine them if you're not on that side. And it works so well that, again, you kind of lose a sense of who's who. That doesn't mean that you don't hear the liberal and conservative and libertarian and even socialist voices, right? They will come up, but nobody owns them. We don't say, well, that's Brad, or, yeah, well, that's what Tammy would say. It's more like, okay, let's put that on one of the giant sheets of paper that we're going to put on the wall back in the before time, right? This was all face-to-face. And then we'll work with that, right? And we'll see, well, okay, now is that we have evidence to support that claim, or is that claim kind of redundant with this other one that we really like, and so on. Now, the before time reference I just made, you know, might make you wonder, well, what happens to this process in 2020? Well, in 2020, they actually isn't a Citizens Initiative Review statewide in Oregon. But they did do something as a pilot test. They actually did a COVID response citizens assembly. Similar concept, but in this case, the randomly selected citizens who are meeting through Zoom, this has already happened this summer, I was studying it with a group, they weren't answering the question, you know, how should you vote on this, or what do you need to know about this? It was more, what are the key principles and guidance we can give our state government for how to respond to COVID-19? So it had a different kind of opportunistic focus because of the nature of the pandemic. And it worked reasonably well. I'm writing a paper about that now. There were some things that were very hard to replicate because you couldn't meet for 4 days straight in Zoom. That's unacceptable. So instead they met for 2 hours every week, and that was fine. It spread out the work, but it was not so fine in that it made it hard to get into the in-depth deliberation that you get into in a 3 or 4 day process, right? So it lacked that kind of depth and rigor that I was used to seeing at these other processes.
We will be back with more Hope for Democracy with Dr. John Gastel in a moment. At the midpoint break for most podcasts, you hear a string of commercials. At SCLO Library, though, we have nothing we're trying to hawk you. We're just interested in nurturing a diverse and rich cultural life in central Pennsylvania. To that end, we keep it rolling with our underwriters from fiction. Promotional consideration for today's episode is brought to you by Sobchak Security. Whether you need a get-a-toe or a ringer full of undies, you can count that with Sobchak Security, you won't be out of your element. When it's time to draw a line in the sand, you won't be entering a world of pain, because we're guaranteed to be calmer than you are. Sobchak Security. Strength. Security. Peace of mind. Closed on Shabbos. If you have an underwriter from fiction that you would like to see sponsor the show, send your promotional copy to bdrain@sclolibrary.org. We are back with Dr. John Gastel talking about his book, Hope for Democracy, which looks at the Citizens Review Board in Oregon, and we talk about other ways in which we can have a more deliberative political process. Dr. Gastel, I'm about to ask you about where I imagine everyone's brain goes, which is this. The Citizens Review Board might be great on the local level, but how do we scale this up? But it occurs to me that if you had this deliberative process going on in tens of thousands of locales across the country, with all the positive outcomes with empowerment, collaboration, and deliberation, the net effect of that would be felt over time even at the national level. Though this also makes me think that deliberative collaboration should probably then be taught in every high school civics class just to make sure everyone is getting these experiences and working together for the common good.
In fact, I teach a course at Penn State on democratic deliberation, and now for the first time, there is a certification in collaborative discussion created by a nonprofit that does excellent work, except when it comes to branding itself, called the Interactivity Foundation. Boy, if that doesn't get you excited, I don't know what will. It's an interesting organization that has helped create this certification, right? And collaborative discussion is tremendously useful in just about any workplace, right? So they're learning about democracy, they're learning about deliberation, and they're developing a very practical skill that, as you say, it'd be great to learn in high school, but you wouldn't just apply it to politics, right? You'd apply it to your workplace. You know, you see these political feuds that are happening at Google. Sometimes they're about politics, but sometimes they're about workplace politics. In either case, what's the harm in having a little collaborative discussion, right? Improving your listening skills, your deep listening skills, and being more effective at articulating your point of view in a way that's receptive to your audience, right? These are things that happen at the Citizens Initiative Review. And in fact, some people have explored how to create classroom modules that teach it. After all, we do mock juries, right? Why not? You might be called for a jury someday. Well, the same logic applies here. So it would be a great justification for having a classroom exercise that gets you right into that role as this kind of special citizen deliberator.
It seems that one of the major themes in the CIR that gives you hope for our democracy is to see common people, not a political class, get involved and invested in the political process, a very bottom-up effect. This theme of engagement is also reflected in the way you and Professor Knobloch wrote your book. In too much academic writing, I found the authors seem to convey authority by using deliberately obtuse language. The effect is that while it reaffirms their legitimacy among other academics, their work is largely unusable to the general public. How have you two taken a different approach with this book, and why?
Well, it started at fundamentals. When we talked about writing a book, I mean, we've published articles in various journals that people are reading and talking about, and that's all very exciting, right? The stereotype that nobody reads academic articles is actually not true. You write a good article, a lot of people read it, and it circulates well, now better than ever. So the book was an opportunity to write something different, right? A more long format discussion of the Citizens Initiative Review and in a larger context. We didn't just want to say, hey, everybody, you should read a book about Oregon, right? We wanted, I mean, and the title of the book actually reflects our process. So let me tell a little story because the book is a story. So here's the story about the book, which doesn't appear in the book. The story goes like this. Okay, we want to write for a general audience. We don't know how to do that. Let's get an editor, right? Let's get an editor before we get a publisher. Let's get an editor who is a commercial fiction editor. And we had meetings with him every month. We would sit down with him and we would talk about what we're writing. Here's the outline and so on. And he was talking about everything as story arcs, right? If we cited a theory, we talked about cultural cognitive theory, which is a real neat theory of how people process information. All these cultural biases shape what we even look at, let alone how we think about it, right? Okay, he's like, well, that's an interesting character you introduced here in chapter three. I'm excited to, you know, see her again. I haven't seen her in a while. I'm starting to wonder if, is she dead? You know, did I miss a scene, right? Did you cut, you know, that? And we're like, oh, right. If, you know, the amount of attention something gets signals to the reader how important it is, right? If we mention something in passing to make a point, that's fine. But if we're going to talk about John Adams over here and Athens over there and cultural connection over here, and then we do it again, well, then we have to keep doing it, right? And there has to be some kind of an arc to that. What is it building up to? Right. In a way, cultural cognitive theory, which I had worked on with some colleagues for years, is kind of a villain. Right? It's this terrible biased processing of information, and we must vanquish it. Right? And so here comes the CIR. Well, you see what's coming, right? It's potentially going to countervail this tendency to be biased in how we process information. And it does that to some extent. Well, that works, right? Now the story's interesting. But of course, people really want characters that aren't theories. And so the book is about two women who actually served on the Citizens Initiative Review and their life experience, two guys who got master's degrees in public policy and then naively thought they could get a law passed just by lobbying the legislature. And these were activists. I don't know what they were thinking, but it turned out they were right. And a philanthropist who had this idea, you know, kind of a kernel of this idea back in the 70s and has been working and working and working. And then it all kind of comes together in Oregon. No one sees it coming except those two guys. And it just is kind of incredible. And then the story kind of ends. Actually, those two guys are now out, right? They didn't survive the 10 years of the CIR. They both moved on to other things. And then it's about the people who are picking it up, right? Why is it coming in Massachusetts, right? It's a similarly goofy kind of personal story. And as someone was observing the other day when we were talking about this, wow, it's really a story about leadership, right? I didn't set out to write a book about democratic leadership, but that's what it takes. People have to care enough to really commit themselves to something for a while. And, you know, it's not necessarily going to be their life's work, right? They may move on and that's okay, but you need to have a new leader, right? Someone else has to step in. And sometimes people ask, well, why hasn't this, you know, been established in every state? Well, maybe the leaders just aren't there, both the citizens and the legislators who stepped up and said, yeah, we need to do this. This would help. So again, the whole book is kind of a story about different people and about this process. The title itself comes from also trying to make this accessible. We were looking for an agent, a professional agent who would help us find a publisher. And one of the agents I met with asked me, you know, what I was doing. And I said, oh, I'm doing this cool book. And he's like, what's the title? And I said, it's Experimental Democracy. And he said, wow, that's a book I will not buy. How do you want me to feel if I read this book of yours? Hopeful. Right. And fortunately, hopeful was the first word that came out of my mouth. He said, well, there's your damn title, you dummy. and there we go. Right. So, yeah, no footnotes. All the references are in essays at the back of the book, right? There's not even a reference section. It's just essays about the material. So the whole thing is narrative beginning to end. And in fact, there's an audiobook version read by Victor Bavine, the voice of the Mueller Report at Audible. He was excited to do it. And so he did an amazing job.
Do you think your next book will be How to Write Academic Narrative and Qualitative Research?
No, it will not. No, I have to keep that secret. Got to keep that
Oh,
safe.
yeah.
No. Actually, my next book will be on online public engagement. That this, as excited as I am about the Oregon CIR, we really need to keep raising our game about ways of getting citizens connected with each other and with government in a way that is more deliberative online, because the whole world is moving online. This pre-COVID, this concern of mine. And so that's the next 10 years of my research. As I continue to write about this process and write about deliberative democracy more generally, a lot of it will be focusing on how we structure our behavior online. We need to put better incentives in front of ourselves to improve our behavior. I mean, improve it in a civic sense, to encourage us to listen to one another and learn from one another and make good decisions together and send strong messages to our elected representatives that are, you know, thoughtful and influential. And that's not how the system's built right now. So there's a lot of work to do.
I spent this morning writing a script for an outreach video on how to vet the news, and by the end of it, my conclusion was that we need to separate social media from our news consumption so we don't inherit yet another filter of cognitive bias and machine learning from our friends, that it's better just to pay a professional newspaper editor to arrange a whole cornucopia of news to consume. But you're saying that there's hope beyond just unplugging. Like, I was pretty down by lunch as far as the state of human relationships through the internet.
I'm guessing you've seen the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma.
I haven't. At
It will
this point,
confirm your worst fears.
it is kind of unforgivable for my job that I haven't seen it yet, but it's always tomorrow, always tomorrow. But you're saying there's hope we can actually have meaningful engagements with each other.
Yeah, I share your concerns. I think you're making a reasonable argument for an alternative way to gather and curate your news. And I, having watched The Social Dilemma for the same sense of professional obligation, I do think the critiques of social media are very strong. And, you know, I'm glad I recommended it on Facebook. I thought this is ironic, and I said that, right? Because there was some good pushback, and the criticisms were, on the one hand, petty, and on the other hand, really thoughtful. The petty one was, well, yeah, now that I've made my millions, I'm going to join a documentary to critique the industry that I've just left, right? That's petty. It doesn't really matter, right? If they've got a good point, they've got a good point. But the better point is, isn't it ironic that documentaries like this are so one-sided, especially when they're expressing a concern about one-sided content? The point being that are you so sure that Facebook's a universally bad thing? I understand why people get off Facebook, and I take breaks from it from time to time. But the phrase that I like is serendipity engine. Aside from all of its commercial manipulation of you and so on, there is no getting around the fact that it is an incredible serendipity engine, right? So just as I say, hey, the Citizens Initiative Review has people, you know, not even knowing each other's partisanship and so on. I'm not so sure that partisanship is a bad thing. It's just, as Cookie Monster now says, cookies are a sometimes food, right? Partisanship should be the same way. Sometimes, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies, I want to see what my community wants me to read. You know, the most powerful, loving tribute. And sure enough, there's the old friend of mine who clerked for her. And yep, there's a story about his experience, and I'm just going to tear up now, right? And so I can get that. But I think the concern in the documentary and what I hear from you is, okay, but they're not treating it as a sometimes food.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to have the same puppet obesity problem that Cookie Monster was staring down, right? Oh boy. So be careful, right?
Many ideas have been discussed in political science circles to improve our democracy, such as more proportional voting, ranked choice voting, eliminating the Electoral College, nonpartisan redistricting, campaign finance reform, eliminating the filibuster, and many more. If you could snap your fingers and change one thing about our democracy, what would it be?
I would go with an open primary that is a top four primary, not a top two, and ranked choice voting in both the primary and the general. And let me explain why. So first, an open primary means anyone can vote for anyone who's running for office, right? So I'm a registered Democrat, but I wouldn't be limited to voting for Democrats. The reason that's important is it kind of crucially depends on where I live, what kinds of candidates I get, including what kinds of Democrats I get. And I could very well be in a district where I think I'd like to encourage that Republican candidate and not that other one. And I like this independent. And, I'm going to put one of my votes in for a Green, right? And I'll rank the candidates I like. And then why top four, right? Why not let the primary, everybody votes that way, just have the top two in a runoff? Well, that can actually create some perverse outcomes, the top two. There could be, and this has actually happened in some cases, where there might be 8 or 10 candidates running. Let's say the district is 60% Republican, but almost all those candidates are Republicans, right? There's, a couple Democrats and the rest are all, well, the Republicans all effectively cancel each other out. And you could actually wind up with two Democrats in the general election, right? A top four primary, that just can't happen, right? You're going to have a representative of the largest party, and you're probably going to have a representative of the second largest party, and the other two are, who knows? Now, again, there's another reason for four, top four, is the others, who knows? Well, the others are going to actually flesh out the political spectrum a little better, right? When you have two candidates, you don't really get to say much. You get to say this one or that one. When you have four candidates, and again, ranked choice voting helps here, you get to say, well, this is the one I like the most. I know she doesn't have a shot, but maybe she does if enough of us believe in her, right? So I'm going to put her as my top choice in second, third, fourth. So the ranked choice voting lets me give better information about my preferences. No votes are thrown away, right? If my favorite candidate drops out quickly, that's fine. We just move to my second choice and so on. But the top four primary gives us some variety in the general. And an irony, I've written an op-ed about this. I think the irony of doing this is the parties hate open primaries. They're skeptical of ranked choice voting, but I actually think it's the only thing that can save them. Because if you use this system, I think you're going to get much more kind of thoughtful candidates coming out ahead, that the extremists can win a primary and then kind of embarrass your party in the general. Sometimes both candidates embarrass their party in the general. And, depending on the structure of the election, there are people like Jesse Ventura who get elected as an independent governor in Minnesota because the other partisan candidates were so bad. So I actually think it could save the party structure, helps the party put better candidates forward. And the ranked choice voting helps voters really kind of say there are things I like and things I don't like, and the extremists are going to get pounded in that system unless there's really a popular sort of groundswell for what they represent, because otherwise candidates who are kind of have a broader base of appeal will do very well. So that change alone I think would actually help one or two third parties in the United States, like the Libertarian and Green Party. I think it would actually help the major parties, but most of all I think it would actually help us elect better representatives who would probably be more deliberative on our half. So a deliberative election gets you a more deliberative government. So that's what I would do of those choices you laid there. Sure, go ahead and chuck the Electoral College, but that's an issue for another day.
What are some practical steps we as citizens can take?
I think the first thing you can do is just take responsibility for your own decisions. And I like to think that we all are trying to do that, but maybe ask yourself, do I know what's on my ballot? Right. In this election, do I literally know everything on the ballot? That can be found out. And if you find something that you don't know about, all right, well, how would I know who to vote for that? I don't know what's going on with the school board or the sheriff or what's this bond measure, right? So it forces you to kind of use your social networks, use your news gathering skills a little bit, and come to a decision. Second point, though, is don't stop there. Democracy isn't just about people filling out ballots. It's about people filling out ballots together. So I encourage everyone, I say this every election, statistically, in the course of your lifetime, your vote probably will never matter. I'm sorry to say it, it's just absolutely statistically true. But if you help other people think about how to vote and you try to persuade them based on what you think is good judgment, there's every reason to believe that you will have an impact on actual outcomes. And in the long run, you'll be feeding into, in a very positive way, a very positive feedback loop, feeding into this more deliberative culture that we really need to help us govern ourselves better. And at the end of the day, that's what democracy is all about.
If you could send one book back in time to 1787 and get it read by the founders, what would it be?
Boy, I would have to go with the screenplay for The Big Lebowski.
And why
is that? It would blow their mind. I'm going to stick with that answer, and I'll give it a better justification instead of just being a smart aleck, which is I do wish the founders had tried to not just look back at Athens and say, wow, let's take the spirit of Athens and put it into our century. But if they had tried a little harder to imagine what the world's going to look like in 200 years, there might have been a little more humility. And they might have recognized just how privileged some of them were in that society. And, you know, the Big Lebowski screenplay maybe isn't, you know, the first choice for doing this. There's various problems with that answer. But it does tell them, this country that you're building is going to be a very different world. How robust is your vision of democracy? How well have you thought about its ability to adapt and change as the society changes? And it's interesting to think how that might have changed the choices they made when drafting our own constitution.
They would have thought, this will not stand, man.
This aggression will not stand.
I flubbed the line. Awesome.
Yeah, and they probably would have had a rug in, you know, the main hall that tied the whole room together.
Dr. John Gastel, thanks for joining us today.
It was a true pleasure. Thank you so much.
This episode's Poetry Nightcap comes by way of lyrics by Ewan McCall, used by permission generously granted by his estate. This is the Ballad of Accounting. In the morning we built the city, in the afternoon walked through its streets, evening saw us leaving. We wandered through our days as if they would never end. All of us imagined we had endless time to spend. We hardly saw the crossroads and small attention gave to the landmarks on the journey from the cradle to the grave. Did you learn to dream in the morning, abandon dreams in the afternoon, wait without hope in the evening? Did you stand there in the traces and let them feed you lies? Did you trail along behind them wearing blinkers on your eyes? Did you kiss the foot that kicked you? Did you thank them for their scorn? Did you ask for their forgiveness for the act of being born? Did you alter the face of the city, make any change in the world you found? Or did you observe all the warnings? Did you read the trespass notice? Did you keep off the grass? Did you shuffle up the pavement just to let your betters pass? Did you learn to keep your mouth shut? Were you seen but never heard? Did you learn to be obedient and jump to at a word? Did you demand any answers? The who and the what and the reason why? Did you ever question the setup? Did you stand aside and let them choose while you took second best? Did you let them skim the cream off and give to you the rest? Did you settle for the shoddy, and did you think it right to let them rob you right and left and never make a fight? What did you learn in the morning? How much did you know in the afternoon? Were you content in the evening? Did they teach you how to question when you were at the school? Did the factory help you? Were you the maker or the tool? Did the place where you were living enrich your life, and then did you reach some understanding of all your fellow men? This podcast is produced by SCLOS Center Region Library. Thanks for Dr. John Gastel for joining us. You can see What's All the Haps at SCLO Library online at schlowlibrary.org. I'm Ben Drain, your old friend and erstwhile companion. Take care until we meet again.